honest, yet it took me a long time to get here.
Both parents have spoken with each other, and they regret what happened. They've had a frank discussion with each other, and they're both of them are keen to now focus on getting back their county jerseys.
That these fellas will get such a f***ing shell shock next Saturday evening that we'll put them back in their f***ing asses for f***ing 10 years.
Okay, 5 years and one day to the day since Dublin won the Leinster Senior Football Championship. As Dublin GA tweeted yesterday, on this day in 2015, our senior footballers beat Westmeath to retain the Leinster title, and Jesus, what a day it was. But we have been looking at a lot of old games and reliving past glories over the last few months, and to be honest, we might have to keep doing that because a club in Dublin was forced to shut its doors and shut everything down actually after a player tested positive for COVID-19. I knew this on Saturday night, actually. It was Man O' War, GFC in Fingal. Scary second team were supposed to be playing them on Sunday morning, and they got word on Saturday night that the game was called off. And I was just thinking, Jesus, imagine that was taking place 12 hours earlier than some even other club who they have played, and then now they're all susceptible. And you had the three clubs in Cork. Now, they've all come back with negative tests, but just one scare caused three clubs to shut down in Cork. So Argadeen Rangers, Ballinascarthy and St Oliver Plunkett still all be able to resume activities this week after their scare. Three West Cork clubs called a halt to activities earlier this week as it was confirmed that club members came in contact with somebody who had contracted the coronavirus. That's somebody at a house party, you know, and it just shows how quickly it can all spread. Another club, so Man O' War, have shut down now because of this positive test, and they have to do the whole contact tracing rigmarole. North Cork club Glanworth have also issued a statement confirming the outcome of a positive test, specifying that it is a player. So again, they're shut down. Connor is with me. He's back from his holidays, and to be honest, I'm starting to think it's a wee bit mad now that we're all back. I didn't care a couple of weeks ago, but now I'm getting a little bit more concerned, especially like, say, I have to go home next week for the first time in 4 or 5 months. And I'm like, Jesus, what have I picked up over the last 2 weeks that I don't know about? I've played a few games already, I've trained. I don't know, I'm just a little bit more scared than I was. What about you?
What a real positive note to start the podcast on, and to welcome me back from my holidays with something like this.
I was woolly, wouldn't you?
Yeah, something just nice and easy to talk about. I read that at Man O' War yesterday, and then about the three Cork clubs there, I think it was last week. And I think, if I'm not mistaken as well, I don't know the name of the club, but there's a Camogie club, I think, who may have withdrawn from a championship because I think there may have been a positive test amongst their club somewhere as well. And this is all, I suppose the worrying thing about this is that it's all come within, so essentially teams were allowed back to play challenge matches within the last week and a half, not even 2 weeks. And there's already, we're talking about 5 or 6 different clubs in different areas of the country. So it just goes to show that nowhere is kind of insulated from it. This isn't related to, you know, a higher number of cases in any particular county. It just goes to show, I think, that the reproductive level, I think, is on the rise. So everyone's kind of vulnerable again. And within, you know, a couple of weeks of us all being joyous about, you know, the GAA returning and everyone being able to go back training, everyone being able to go back playing games, we're all of a sudden worrying again about, you know, the possibility of picking this thing up and then passing it on to our loved ones and stuff like that. So yeah, it's worrying. Like I suppose, while the cases at the moment are kind of there's only a small minority of cases. And you mentioned the clubs in Cork, and I think all the tests came back from that negative. So I suppose I'd like to see a kind of a wider sample of these sorts of incidences before I start to get really worried. But from a starting point, it's a bit concerning for sure.
Yeah, like the clubs in Cork, actually, you're right, almost a red herring in the fact that three of them shut down, but all three have come back with negative tests. But at the time, I was thinking, well, the three clubs in Cork shut down, and statistically, there's obviously more in Dublin with more cases, you know, just if you go off what we've seen historically over the last few months. But as I say, they've all been negative now, but it's in the community a little bit. There are people meeting more. You're seeing that the average age is down of people contracting the virus, so yeah, they're going to spread it more. This case in Cork was a house party, and then it happened to be players in contact with this person who tested positive. Thankfully, none of them had it, but I don't know about you. Like, I'm not feeling as comfortable playing anymore. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm still going to, because I'm not comfortable to miss a whole season. Do you know, because of that? And I don't even feel comfortable saying, "Hey lads, by the way, I'm not playing." Again, there's that culture thing, like, where it's not a good enough excuse. It's almost like an injury. Like, you know, if you have a little pull in your muscle and you probably shouldn't play, you're still going to play unless you have a broken bone. Do you know, it's a threshold again.
But I'd say you're less comfortable, Conan, about it, because possibly, I could be wrong here, but because especially with you being involved in Skerries, so a lot of players you would have known would have been directly affected by the cancellation of the game with Man of War. So it's closer to home for you, if that makes any sense. So as opposed to me looking at maybe four or five clubs in Cork and then looking at the club in Dublin and thinking, well, you know, it hasn't affected anywhere in Mayo yet. Whereas if it was a neighbouring club or a club we were meant to play, then we'd probably hit home a little more. But I think that's what's going to happen. I think if the more of these incidences kind of pop up, that the more people are going to be concerned, and the more people are going to, you know, the more people are going to start thinking about whether it's all worthwhile. Do you know what I mean? And I think that the real thing about this, especially in the GAA context, is that so like, we're looking at a lot of sports that resumed professionally, let's say, but they're all within really controlled environments where the players and everybody involved is subjected to testing and all this sort of stuff. Yeah. Whereas the GAA, through no fault of their own, they can provide the guidelines, but it's up to individual players and, you know, individual clubs to follow them and stuff. So, you know, we're talking about, you know, a fella that was, you know, people that were out at a house party and then in contact with, you know, some of their teammates who might have been, you know, who might have been affected. And then, like, I was reading, I think about, there was a player at a training session recently who had a test for COVID-19, but didn't actually inform management until after the training session. So he had trained with his teammates and then informed them afterwards. So if that test was to come back positive, who knows what's going to happen there? So, you know, that I think that's kind of really, really prevalent as well. Is that, like, you're really reliant on the responsibility of individuals and individual clubs and stuff like that. And that's what makes the GAA more vulnerable, let's say, than a lot of other sports.
Yeah, and that's, like, you're right, that was in the, was it Dennis Walsh that did that piece?
Yes, it was,
We'll do the paper review. Don't skip ahead, Connor. It's actually, you're right to bring that up now, because I sort of felt a bit of sympathy for him as well, because again, that's the, not the culture, like, not that anybody would say, don't tell us that you had a test, but he probably just feels like he has to go to training, and if he doesn't train, he's going to go down the pecking order. I don't know this guy's story or whatever, but I did sympathize with him a little bit, but yeah, you're right. Like, it, in this stage, we all just need to be a bit more wise and just have a bit more cop on about it all. Like, you know, and we all have to help each other out, because that's the only way it's going to work. But it's not lucky. I think this is a warning sign now, because if this was happening next week, so the championships are starting on Friday. Like, you know, the one in Wexford starts on Friday, kicks everything off. And if this happens next week, and if it happens in Wexford, or if it happens in Dublin, which the hurling championship starts on Sunday, like, what happens then? Like, that's still not clear. Like, if a club has to shut down for 2 weeks and there's a positive test, is the championship going to go on without them?
That's the thing. Like, I really don't know myself, Conan, and we've talked about it a few times, and like, I've read as much as I possibly can about the difference between close contacts and all that sort of stuff, and whether you're within 2 meters, you know, for a certain amount of time of a person on the pitch, and all the stuff regarding contact tracing. So listen, that's like, I don't envy the COVID officers and clubs, and I don't envy, like, people in county boards who are responsible for having to implement any kind of anything that's going to, like, happen as a consequence, whether, like, teams will be withdrawn from championships and stuff like that. And to be honest, like, because I think I was maybe lulled into a false sense of security because the number of cases had gone down and stuff like that. And, you know, it looked like a large pockets of the country were largely free of the virus. But I suppose the thing about this is that, like, it was always susceptible to, you know, some sort of, I know there hasn't been a huge surge or anything like that. Like, there's been a little increase in the number of cases and maybe the reproductive rate. But there was a chance that this might happen when society would reopen, I suppose. And even more prevalent when you're talking about sports like the GAA, when there's going to be mass gatherings to a certain degree, maybe of 50 and 100 people. So listen, who knows what's going to happen. But like this, the thing is that like this has all happened as a result of kind of challenge games that have taken place, you know, over the last, you know, week and a half to 2 weeks. Like I know my club, for example, played our first challenge game lately, whereas from next week on, championships are resuming across the country. So there's going to be games coming thick and fast. And if anything, the likelihood of this, of these sorts of things happening is going to increase even more. So listen, I hope it doesn't happen, but what's happened in the last week and a half has kind of served as a warning sign for what could happen when the action returns, and there's going to be far more games in a lot of counties throughout the country.
Yeah, well, it's returning this weekend. TG Cahir have announced eight games, four hurling, four football. Two hurling ones, they kick it off this weekend. So on Friday, it's in Wexford, St Martins v Other Tabala. And Sunday, the hurling championship in Dublin, Ballyboden v Kilmacud. Next Friday, Kilmallock v Napiercy in Limerick. And then the Sunday is the first football game on TV, and it's in Cork, Castlehaven v Carbery Rangers. There's Galway that same day as deferred coverage, Sarsfield v Portumna. And then the Friday after that, I'm obviously most interested in this, is the Down Football Championship, Kilcrew v Mayo Bridge. Although I was actually excited about this because I thought it was knockout, but there's a back door in that. So I was thinking, geez, Kilcrew v Mayo Bridge, that's insane. But they're both going to go back to the quarters at least, you know, so it doesn't matter. Yeah. Cardiff Inn are out then that Sunday, and the third coverage is Simonstown Gales v Skrine in Meath. RTE have one game announced so far, I think I'm right in saying. That's August 1st. Cork, Glen Rovers v St Finbars. But so it's good just to see some like football and hurling on the TV schedule again. And to that note, like the GA have announced some match day regulations that they want people to follow. So I suppose we'll go through some of them. The first one is a designated water break. So after 15 or between 15th and 20th minute on each half, the referee can decide when the players all go for a water break. I'm seeing this in the Premier League. A lot of people hate it. I actually don't mind it when I'm watching because it gives me a chance to go to the toilet.
Your own water break.
And I drink a lot of tea, so actually I start to hate around the 38 minute mark normally when I'm watching a Premier League match. So it's a good relief for me anyway. But I don't know, like, I'm not really one to take much water during the game because I'm usually just looking for oxygen. You know, usually out of breath. But like, yeah, people might enjoy it, but I can see it being I can see it frying your head because you go over and the manager will be looking to give you a quick team talk, and when you're in the middle of a match, it's the last thing you need.
The problem with, I suppose, the problem that I see with the water breaks in the Premier League is that it completely breaks up momentum. And it's nearly now, because like we become used to it and the players have become used to it, that there's nearly a drop off or something just before the water break or something like that, if that makes any sense. But in regards to the GA, this is something that's going to take a lot of getting used to, because especially under the new circumstances. I'll just use like an example. Like, we played our first challenge game yesterday, for example. So because you're obviously obliged to bring your own water, right? And your gear isn't, it's not going to be over in the dugout. So yesterday we played a challenge match we played it in quarters. So it was basically essentially the same time that, you know, you'd play before a water break comes in. But all our water, like, we had left our bags up where the dressing room is, and we were like 150 yards away. So for the first, we didn't have time, you know, we didn't have time to go up and get our water. So we didn't even have any anyway. And I was thinking about that then during the game, like, say, so the championship for us is on August Bank Holiday weekend. Like, and if the weather was class, for example, you know, you probably could do with water, you know, more than every 15 minutes. You probably need a drink every couple minutes. So what do you do then if there's not water breaks? Are there designated people? Do the subs line up at certain, you know, there's a sub that has the, you know, the water bottle for a cornerback and a wing back on a certain side, and, you know, for a half forward and a wing forward on the other side and stuff like that. So it's going to take so much getting used to. Like, I'm not particularly in favor of the idea of like a water break during the middle of the pitch, but if you're not allowed water carriers, there's going to have to be some time, you know, for players to get water on board, because we're not all like you, Conor. We can't just we can't all survive without our supply of our water during the game.
I'm not saying I don't need water. I'm saying I prioritize oxygen first, and I don't have enough oxygen to get the water on board. So I'll just skip ahead what you're saying there, because one of the other regulations is that subs and team officials should be positioned on opposite sides of the pitch. So even, like, you know, your examples, probably it's not a bad suggestion having somebody lined up for the wing back and the cornerback, but he can't beat the other side of the pitch because the other team is supposed to beat the other side of the pitch.
Yeah, scratch that.
So I'm wondering, like, well, that, there's not that many flashpoints anyway, but anyway, it's probably not a bad thing anyway, having the other team. It always seems, things seem way more easily diffused when the two dugouts aren't on top of each other and they're the other side of the pitch. It always seems a bit more relaxed, you know, because you're not hearing what they're shouting and stuff as well. You know, when sometimes when you hear a manager say something or he comes up past the dugout, and that just sort of, it gets everybody else going, you know, and then suddenly there's fever pitch and then people on the pitch are reacting to that. Selectors are no longer allowed onto the pitch, probably not a bad thing. Only a maximum of 24 players, but I thought that was the case for Championship anyway, like only 9 subs. I thought you had to do that.
Yeah, I thought it was closer to 26.
Thank you, right, yeah.
But I think it's, intercounty is 26 anyway. If anything, I know in club football down here in the last couple of years, there's been a couple of examples where you'd have like a county final and the program, there'd be like 49 players on the program, ridiculous like that. So if that helps to put an end to that sort of practice, then yeah, I'm all for it.
Like that should be the case anyway, because that helps the person who's 12th or 13th sub. Like, you know, it's like, well, just go and play with the second team. Like you're probably not going to get a game here. I know you train and you're part of it and stuff like that, but yeah, I don't know. It's just, I remember one time being a sub in a championship in Derry and it came on with a minute to go. And then I couldn't play the reserve championship, you know, and I was like, what was the point of that? Whereas if I had been saved from that substitute bench, I would have been able to play. But a maximum of 5 in football and 7 in hurling team officials. Again, I don't think that's a bad thing, and probably most clubs don't have as many. But like, I was thinking about a team like Ballinderry and Derry, who used to notoriously have about 30 selectors, and they were all there. And again, that was part of the, sometimes I thought that helped intimidate the referee. And, you know, even when those new rules came in, they sort of specify you're only allowed a certain amount on the dugout. I don't think it really affected a lot of clubs, and a lot of the refs don't implement it. What do you think of that one?
No, I think the same. And especially as you said there, like, the rule about, you know, opposite sides of the pitch, I don't think is a bad one either. Like, I think that would be a good one if it could be enforced, you know, like in general, as opposed to just for COVID-19 and stuff. But like, I suppose the thing is that you might have a pitch where the side of the pitch where the dugouts aren't on is absolutely tiny, you know, and not, you know, it's not, there might be a fence there or a wall or something like that, and you can't facilitate that. But I think you make a good point there when, like, I've been in situations where, you know, your backroom team, the size of your backroom team, or even the size of your bench, and things, you know, things get out of hand. It's like, it's not supposed to happen, but it happens. And then, you know, sometimes that the referee can be influenced if there's more people bellowing at him the whole time. No, he can be influenced. He can be influenced in one of two ways. He can be influenced by, you know, getting intimidated by that and starting to award things to the team with bigger representation. Or he can go the other way and say, sod them, because he won't shut up. I'm just going to keep, you know, kind of giving decisions to the opposition team. But like, no, that's like, I'm not involved in a backroom team or management team, but I would say that like 5 for football and 7 is plenty to be involved anyway, especially under these circumstances.
The use of dugouts is discouraged. As soon as I see discouraged, I think, well, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
is it a rule or not? Like, you know, and I also was thinking, what happens if it starts raining? Like, you know, it's going to be a nightmare if you're being discouraged to stay out of the dugouts. I can't see that being implemented. It says, but they may be used provided the government guidelines around social distancing are followed. I mean, a lot of dugouts won't be able to follow it. So I don't know. I'll be interested to see if that one's held up. And again, these players are all training together anyway, like, you know, so it's what's the other one? The referee has the authority during the game to send any person in breach of the regulation to the stand. I mean, the referee sort of has that authority anyway, just doesn't always use it. And the last one here is, there'll be no handshakes, no spinning, no nose clearing. I know a lot of people will be like, well, there shouldn't be anyway, but do you know what? Sometimes I think you need to do that.
The
one that stuck out for me was huddles must be socially distanced.
I mean, does that defeat the purpose of a huddle? Is a huddle still a huddle if players are socially just, you know, if they're 2 meters apart, even if they're a meter apart, unless they have the longest arms in the world and
boys, get closer.
They can stretch around each other, but
we're too far apart. Lad, get closer to each other.
Yeah.
I just don't see that one. going ahead. Like, you know, there's a lot of, like, sometimes there's important talk, sometimes there's a tactics board in the middle, people are sort of huddling around naturally to look, even if they don't have arms around each other. I just can't imagine 24 players being 2 meters apart from each other in a big circle and the manager talking. Yeah, but anyway, like, so that's the regulations. I'm looking forward to it. I love just seeing fixtures listed out on a TV schedule. I just hope that we can bloody get them done.
What fixture, by the way, just to say, Conan, like, is in the, like, this is, it's nearly like the counties themselves, like, you know, had got these particular fixtures ready for TV this weekend.
Yeah.
I mean, just like you're on about Kilkenny Mayo Bridge. I've been told that, like, in Cork, you don't get a bigger game than Glen Rovers against the Bears. And even in Galway, I'm just looking, Carfin, obviously All-Ireland champions 3 times in a row, and they're playing Oughtred, who won the All-Ireland Intermediate Championship last year. So what a kind of step up and welcome to senior championship football for Oughtred and Galway. But even that, then you've Ballyboden and Kilmacud, two of the biggest teams in Dublin, and in Limerick, Kilmallock against Nibirsheik. Both of whom are Munster Championship winners, if not even All-Ireland winners in recent years, if I'm not mistaken. So you've got pretty much the pick of the bunch, but something that you can start to kind of plan your weekend around again, like, you know, which is another kind of sign that things are sort of coming back to normal, which is great.
Yeah, I'm excited. Okay, I'm not going to rain on the parade. I'm going to stay with excitement. And I want to talk about Jack Charlton now. I know he's a soccer legend, but I think he's a legend in Irish sport in general. And he brought a lot to the country. Like, you know, he brought everybody together to start off with to support the Irish team at a time when that was more of a football thing, like that, or that soccer thing. That's what the soccer players did. They all just, that was their fraternity, and the GAA had theirs. And it wasn't long before that where GAA people weren't allowed to play soccer, and vice versa, you would have been discouraged. I was thinking about Jack though, because obviously there's been a lot of good eulogies and a lot of tributes to him, and he was a bit more old school in his methods. Of course, he took over in 1986. And I did start thinking about, sometimes there's real beauty in simplicity. Like, you know, somebody who knows exactly what they want, and they're going to get people fit, and they're going to get them working hard, and they're going to make them tough. And, like, that's your lowest base. Like, you're not going to go below that. And when you have a manager like that who comes in and just sets that standard, and I mean now in GAA or soccer, like, it's good. Like, you know, you probably need more going forward, but when somebody comes in and it's just like, you know, we're going to work hard and we're going to stay together and we're going to be tough, like, there's a lot to be said for that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like, it's, you have to have a certain character, you have to have a certain kind of type of individual who's able to kind of implement that message, let's say, amongst his team. There has to be complete trust. First of all, there has to be complete belief by the man who's kind of looking to get across that simplistic a message, or somebody will just think of them as a bluffer who just isn't prepared to put the work in. And then they have to have the personality to be able to transmit that, so that the players themselves will ultimately completely buy into it. And that was definitely the case with Ireland. Like, you know, I mean, and this has been mentioned a couple of times over the weekend since Jack Charlton passed away, but, like, even though his style of play was the most simplistic, but it wasn't as if there was universal backing for it. Let's say, you know, the famously Eamon Dunphy went against it. John Giles might have had kind of reservations about it, and he wouldn't have been the only one. I mean, like, you're talking about dropping the likes of Liam Brady, like, probably one of Ireland's most talented players ever, and David O'Leary for a long time as well before he got back in. So, like, there wasn't kind of universal approval for it, but, like, Jack believed in what he wanted to do. And more importantly, he convinced his players to, like, absolutely believe in it, because otherwise, like, players will pick up on any shred of doubt, and it wasn't there in his case. So, yeah, so that, like, there is a comfort in that, I suppose, in that, like, this guy here is, it might be simple, but he's absolutely clear in his belief that this is going to work. And if he can transmit that well enough amongst, like, a group of players, well, then, like, the impact it can have is powerful.
So this is, like, yeah, I was thinking about the personality thing as well. So obviously we can talk about coaching. There's a lot more elements to managing a team and being successful, and personality is a big one. Just having that confidence in yourself, like, it fills everybody else around you with it. Like, and when you have, like, when you are that sure of yourself and you're sure of your own vision, it is infectious. And I was thinking about Jim McGuinness. Like, you know, he's probably the best example in the GAA. And I think he's probably a good hybrid of somebody who brought, like, you know, so much coaching mechanisms to it as well. But he absolutely just wanted his lowest base to be the fittest team and the hardest working team. And he was able to fuse that with the belief of winning. Like, you know, the book that Kevin Cassidy did, This Is Our Year, I think it was Declan Bogue who wrote it.
Yeah.
Kevin Cassidy talked just about the language that Jim McGuinness brought to the table. It showed them, like, say, Dublin's formation on a PowerPoint or whatever, and he brought it up in a dark room, and everyone was looking at it, and the way he suggested it was, here's Dublin, and this is how we're going to beat them. Do you know? And
just
that difference, like, it's like how often have you been in a changing room where you've just been spooked, or, like, you know, that's almost the idea of, like, telling you how great the other team is and how up for it they're going to be. Whereas somebody like Jim McGuinness, you know, they were able to come in and pick out holes in the other team and pick out the great stuff about their team and show you exactly how you're going to beat them and tell you it was going to happen over and over. And I think in Jim McGuinness's book, actually, he talked about they were doing these runs in the sand in 2010 or whatever the preseason was before he took over in 2011. And he said to them, he wasn't going to do it that early, but he just said to them, he vocalized it. He said, we are going to win an Ulster Championship. And, like, just from the outset then, being able to say that and then just fill everybody with the belief, I think it's just so powerful.
Yeah, yeah. You can imagine what the players would have been thinking coming out of that meeting when he said, this is Dublin's formation. This is where what we're going to do. Now, in fairness to him, like, the Declan Bogue's book would have referred to the infamous game between them in 2011. So they didn't actually end up winning that. But, like, a few years later, after Donegal won an All-Ireland in 2012 and kind of tanked in 2013, they obviously played them in the semi-final. And by all accounts since, I think Donegal had a training camp in Carton House, I think, the week before the semi-final. Absolutely. And then came out of it absolutely convinced they were going to beat Dublin. And they did. And they showed they beat Dublin in such a way that completely transformed the way Dublin played in the years since. Mm. You know, Dublin's template from maybe 2015 onwards has been based a lot on their experiences against Donegal in 2014. So you can see the transformative impact that particular incident you referred to had on Donegal. And Jim McGuinness is a perfect example. And, like, I know, like, I've told this story a couple of times in this podcast, so, like, I promise this the last time, but you mentioned Jim McGuinness's book there. And just in the year before he took over Donegal, he was with the Donegal under 21s. And there was a connection in our club to McGuinness, so they got him down for a training session, and he trained us for about 2 hours, and it was the most basic stuff. Yeah. I mean, like, the first drill was like two lines, and basically running at each other. You know that drill, hand passing back and over to each other. The first drill you'd probably do in under sixes, but he just, like, throughout the whole session with that drill as well, it was like, you're going to do this at 100%, and he stopped it after 30 seconds. Because we weren't doing it 100%. And, like, we never made that mistake after that, because he introduced punishments and stuff like that. And they were torturous. It was a 2 hour session. It was absolute torturous. But by the end of it, like, we were coming out of, oh my God, we could do anything here. Like, you know, and then I was reading Jim McGuinness's book then a few years later, and he said the exact same thing as his first session with Donegal. He said he asked them to do 100% and they weren't doing it. So he got them to do it again. And it was just like, he kind of went on afterwards that, like, after a while of doing that, and after a while that the team were so used to his message and kind of how he wanted to go about things, that there was complete belief. And it was obvious to them winning the All-Ireland in 2012, going so close in 2011 and going so close again a couple of years later. So in a GAA example, I think that what you're talking about there. Now, granted, Jim McGuinness also had the kind of tactical nuances that Jack Charlton mightn't have had as well. And it would be unfair to Jim McGuinness to undermine that aspect for Donegal as well. But, like, it's clear that on the other side of things, he also had what Jack Charlton has, was that personality, that ability to transmit his message to the team, and that ability to instill complete belief in his players and his squad that what they did was going to achieve success, and it did.
Mm. And, like, and that's the other, like, Jack was funny as well. He wasn't worried or riddled with sort of self-doubt like a lot of GA managers are. He didn't care about how he was coming across in interviews. He was just completely relaxed all the time. And I thought about Klopp in that instance, and it wasn't a GA example, but, like, that stuff, it spreads as well. Like, you know, when you are, like, confident, and, like, again, like, the same way panic spreads when you're a manager who's worried about things, like, that goes through the team, and then that's why people never take a chance, or they play safe, and they don't play to the best of their ability, because they know that the manager on the sideline is shitting themselves as well, and he's sort of transmitting that. And someone like Charlton didn't do that. But there's a fine line between confidence and cockiness. And I thought of, I remember Stephen McDonnell, his back got up when I mentioned this, because he was captain of Armagh at the time when he was on our podcast. We're 2011, Armagh were playing Derry, and they came walking out into the pitch, you know, with this real strut. And I think it was down in Clonus, and But he said that they were told to do that by their psychologists, and it was, you know, the idea, like, you know, they owned this arena or whatever, and they got absolutely hammered by Derry that day in the Ulster semi-final, like, you know. But he still stands over and says that wasn't the case or whatever. But I do always just think there's a fine line between confidence and cockiness, but the best manager is able to do that. And Jack was sort of a perfect example as well, because as confident as he was and as much assurances that he brought the Irish people, I think, you know, we never let them get ahead of themselves either, right? You know?
Yeah. Any excuse to mention that Armagh versus Derry game, of course. When you mentioned Klopp there as well, just thinking of, you know, the complete, not being afraid to kind of make a fool of himself around like that. And just thinking back to, like, I'd say if you asked the question, he was asked about the coronavirus early doors. And he was like, yeah, what do I know? Like, I don't know anything about it. You know, why are you asking me? And I'd say if you asked that question of the 20 Premier League managers at the time, that 19 of them probably would have tried to, you know, come across with some sort of opinion or scientific opinion or something like that, because they felt they might look like a fool if they said something like Klopp did. But he was just completely honest and not afraid to make a fool of himself. Now, granted, he's kind of had the few years to be able to be safe in himself doing that. But you're right, like, even the smallest things like that, how they transmit themselves publicly and stuff like that. If the public think, if the public have that perception of your manager, you know, from kind of wider standpoint, you know that, like, you know, you're going to, you know, have complete faith in them from within the camp itself. Going back to McGuinness, he was probably the perfect example of that.
And just before we leave it, because we have Ryan McCluskey coming in, so he's been in the changing room, high level in soccer and high level in GAA. So I wanted to chat to him just sort of about the differences and the stuff you can bring over from both sports. But I saw Mick Foley was tweeting about a statue of Jack Charlton, and he's making the case for it to be in Mayo.
Yeah.
For a number of reasons, like, is to reflect at how Jack sort of spread football and soccer into the rural areas in recognition of the immigrant story. So we connected with the Charlton years and allowed us to look at England differently. And just that Jack loved the place and he went fishing there. But I did see someone writing back to him. So Johnny Heavey, I think he's from Dublin. I guess he's from Dublin, but he was saying, why not Lansdowne Road? Feels like a statue in Mayo would just gather moss. Could we not just rename Kilchima after him instead? And I thought, who better to put it to than Kilchima's favourite son?
I'd love to know the context. Did he mention why Kilchima? I mean, because listen, like, all of Mayo would consider itself, you know, would consider to have a connection with Jack Charlton, but the connection would definitely be in Ballina, where he has a house. Where he had a house for years. Like, I think he was over on a visit years and years and years ago and fell in love with the place and fell in love with fishing in the River Moy. He's had that connection with Ballina because he's been there for so long. And even, it was funny, I heard a couple of stories over the weekend that for years, like, Jack Charlton used to come fishing in Ballina all the time. And just, like, you know, you're used to, if you see people fishing, it's just, you know, a couple of lads, you know, perched by the side of a river. But when people got wind of Jack Charlton, that he was fishing along the River Moy, that, like, he used to gather a crowd to just watch him sitting there in silence fishing. he was that big of a deal. But listen, if it came to renaming Kilchima, I definitely have to consider it. But I'm not aware of any special connection Jack Charlton has with here as opposed to with Ballina, where it's probably more appropriate.
Kilchima says no. That's what I'm getting
no,
from.
No.
Anyway, next up, we got Ryan McCluskey.
Doherty, who's a fantastic analyst, and I mean, I really heed what he would say in your program.
I think Tyrone are going to win. I'm going to go with them. As much as I predicted Dublin to win the All Ireland at the start of the year, I just think Tyrone are going too well. They're unaffected by the other team, too well set up. I think they've been preparing for Dublin for 2 years, they're ready for them. I'm going to go with them, yeah. Alright, delighted to have Fermanagh legend, and I suppose a legend of the soccer world up north as well, Ryan McCluskey, on the line. But Ryan, I typed in your name with Porter Down beside it on YouTube to see if I could get any cool goals or anything, and the first search that comes up is it's a rally, a UVF rally at a bonfire night in Belfast somewhere. What do you have to say about that?
No comment, I wasn't involved that night, to be fair. No, that wasn't. I never actually knew that, but there you go. That could be my claim to fame. I wouldn't say maybe the term legend maybe is overused now, but listen, I enjoyed the years playing both, and I suppose was fortunate that I caught under different managers as well, and I was lucky to do that. The body mightn't say that at this age, but I loved every minute of it, and I suppose like any other ex-player that will say the same. You know, it just flies and it goes in so quickly at the time. You know, you're thinking you have a lifetime to play, but no, it's not the case. You know.
Well, like you won an Irish League with Portadown, didn't you, and a CIS Cup as well?
It was actually it was Division Two, obviously at the time. Then to get re-promoted, there were a number of issues and financial irregularities that had happened before my time, unfortunately. I'd moved from Dungannon at the time, and then we got promoted. And I think to this day, we are the only side to win a major trophy outside of the Premier League, or the now Premier League, which was Division One, obviously, then back then as well. You know, so it was massive to get back up. And unfortunately, then the club went through the same tenure again of going back down. And unfortunately, they've again actually reinstated themselves in the top division and got back into the Premiership as well this year. Despite COVID, they were promoted as one of the I think we're up there at the top with you know, I think the consistent scores or average scores or points. Mm. So it was nice to see get back up as well. And enjoyed my time at the club. Wasn't involved in any of that other kind of carry on. So
but you're an interesting one, because you were playing obviously in the early noughties as well, and that was probably the time that Joe Brolly still creams himself over. Like, you know, were you able to play with Fermanagh and play a bit of soccer as well? Like, so how did you find the contrast when you were going from changing room to changing room? Was there a difference in both sports?
Well, obviously, listen, I suppose as well, in the environment, in terms of the soccer environment as well, you know, you would probably get that kind of, maybe the pretty boy tag would have been bounced about in terms of when you were going back into a Gaelic change room. But in terms of the soccer change room in itself, yeah, there was plenty of lads running around, you know, worrying about their maybe hairstyles and what they looked like maybe going out, you know, into games. There would have been a bit more kind of, well, players would have been a lot more vocal actually in a soccer change room, and certainly more opinionated, probably for maybe the wrong reasons, in terms of, you know, you then go into a GA change room. And yeah, not to say the boys aren't vocal in the change rooms, but certainly there's a more controlled maybe environment, I would say, definitely in a GA change room, you know, than the soccer change room itself. There would have been a difference now in terms of possibly, yes, the attitude. And I know, listen, the Premier League has transformed as well and improved. But, you know, during my time and playing the GA change room and the GA setup for an amateur sport, it was miles ahead in terms of training and just development more than anything else. You know, and even people may say about Fermanagh being a smaller county, you know, there was no comparison. We actually had a Portadown coach come down one of the evenings and watched one of the GA sessions. I think it was under Malik O'Rourke at the time, and he just couldn't get over the whole setup from you know, pre-training to training to post-training, and just how the whole session was conducted. You know, so in terms of, you know, the differences, you know they were very, very stark, I suppose, at that stage. And obviously over the years, I know that the soccer change room has started to change as well, you know.
Yeah, I suppose they were relying more on skill, I suppose, which was, you need a lot more, I take it, in that sport. But I actually wanted to ask you, because I played soccer for a little bit, and I found it very frustrating, like, just you talking about the how vocal people were. And it's not even the change room, it's on the pitch. And it actually, it doesn't come from a bad place. Sometimes it's well-intended, but it's just, that's the culture almost. It's just, it's whinging to me. Like, you know, it's just everybody just giving out about every single play. And it wrecked my head. How did you find that?
It would have been very opinionated, I suppose. you know, you kind of have to look at it then and maybe the context were, and I was fortunate to play in the Irish League, you know, for some people it was their livelihoods as well on the line. So, you know, I suppose you could argue that they were entitled to their opinion, you know, albeit it might not have been the best opinion at times, but it certainly was a lot more vocal. And you're right, there were times, God knows, when you could have probably grabbed a couple of boys with a throat, and probably vice versa. A couple of boys probably could have grabbed me with a throat as well. But, you know, I think, guys, as time, as I said, has went on, and just knowing lads that are still obviously playing in the league, and even local lads, you know, with some of the local kind of clubs as well, that the game and the change rooms have moved on. And I think it's like anything else. Listen, there's a lot more education out there. We blame the likes of social media times, and in terms of you know, some of the stuff that may be on it, but in terms of coaching and even management and you know even systems, going back to stuff like that, you know, there is a lot more logic and learning for players out there now. It is obviously accessible to everybody. So I think as that side of things has moved on from a social media point of view, I think that the kind of knowledge base and for everybody involved with both codes has certainly improved, and I think maybe standards, you know, have improved because of that. And maybe going back to that point, maybe there's not as much shouting. If a coach does explain something, you know, it's kind of dead and buried. But we definitely played with a few feisty characters along the lines, and they weren't afraid to let us know what was right or wrong, you could say.
Would you react to that? Because I always find it very hard to not turn around and tell someone to shut up, like, you know, which obviously isn't good either on my part.
I suppose, listen, I myself, and even to name the likes of Shane McCabe, who was kind of doing both, and a few lads as well at that time. Even we had McGinn running around at that stage as well, Niall, and certainly in Dungannon, you know, and there was quite a few actually GA lads that were playing both codes, and at that stage actually there probably would have been a good Gaelic team in that change room in Dungannon, but at that stage it actually wasn't too bad. It's like anything else, I suppose. It depends on how maybe bad or something happened. I can't think really of any kind of cases that really stand out. To be honest, I suppose like most players, I was far too hard on myself as well. And the times, you know, where maybe I mispassed the ball or didn't run or whatever the case may be, I usually would have a tantrum with myself, Borderline Tourette's moment. So I think it was clear that nobody else had to kind of remind me what the problem was, because it was usually tongue-lashing myself and making it known to everybody, which is a good thing and a bad thing, obviously, as well. But, you know, so now that there wasn't really too many times now that I would have went and maybe had a go back, you know.
Well, that's actually interesting, because in my club in Derry, there was only one player who played soccer, but he was the one, every time he made a mistake, when he was playing GA, he would shout, "Fuck off, Donnelly!" And his name is Donnelly, like, you know, when he's shouting at himself. And it was just such a culture shock to everybody else.
Yeah. It was, and certainly for those who maybe hadn't played both codes, or been involved, or maybe had other experience in other codes, certainly if you're in a soccer change room and there's a lot of, I suppose, maybe egos, and that's maybe wrong saying egos, you can get that in any change room, but there's certainly a lot of vocabulizing maybe and being quite opinionated. But, you know, if you're a quiet, introverted type of character, that is a hard environment to go into, and I just think with the GA, you know room, change room, you know, it's certainly different, when I was playing, certainly anyway, there was kind of a lot more focus and a kind, maybe a bit more knowledge maybe about the change room as well, which is why I think maybe the soccer change rooms now, you know, would be a different place and a different environment, and I'm sure they have improved. Although, listen, there's always going to be characters in any change room as well, you know.
Well, I suppose for you, like, you've got great experience now in that, like, yeah, you play GAA soccer and you've had all these different managers and different regimes and played with all these different players. Like, it must be a great thing now for you just to pick the best examples out of each of these things and sort of decide what works well. Like, because we were talking about Jack Charton earlier, and you were just that idea of, Sometimes like something very simple, a coach who comes in and just wants hard work and he knows what he wants and it's nothing too extreme, sometimes that works, like, you know. But obviously you can, if you want to sort of go on to the next level, you would take a bit of that and then try to fuse it with something else somebody else is doing.
Listen, it's been great to be, I suppose, in so many different kind of coaching environments, and I'm just being fortunate to you know, play for my club for a number of years, and obviously then at the Skin and Gales, and then obviously with Fermanagh, and then obviously that soccer background as well. And you're right, you kind of do pick the traits that you feel you enjoy the most maybe as a player as well, and you try and implement them. And saying that, listen, it's not just that easy either. You know, I've certainly enjoyed my time at Birr thus far as well. And I suppose I am cutting my teeth at the minute, and it was the right fit at the right time as well. But there's nothing beats playing, you know, as much as you know, I have enjoyed the last year and a bit now. And you do try and implement them things, but you know, it's probably the control element more than anything else. You know, there's still that side of me that wants to go out and maybe I just get involved in an episode of play, whatever that may be, and you know, maybe look for a pass, whatever it is. And it's not the same running down the sideline, you know, kicking somebody or trying to go on or anything like that. But no, it's just hard to take that out. But no, listen, it's been brilliant, Dan. I've loved listening every minute of playing, and thus far, you know, I've tried to use, you know, the best of those different managers in both codes as well, and I suppose in that sense, you know, I have no issue with lads, you know, playing different sports, whether it's soccer and Gaelic or Gaelic and hurling, whatever the case may be, even rugby, you know, and there's quite a few handballers at the club as well, you know, right. If you can multi-skill and you know, have as much kind of and high skill levels as you can as a player, I feel that can only benefit for you know, your team as well. So for me, that's a big thing. And if lads, you know, want to do that, I was fortunate to be in that position. And, you know, I would back any lads in that position as well.
Tell me, you probably think of it differently now in the position you're in, but did you find it? Yeah, I know you said that the guy from Portadown came down and he was so impressed with the GAA training, but was there almost too much control over a GAA session as well? Like, again, sometimes I think you could get a good sort of middle ground there, like where the soccer's a bit more relaxed and there's a bit more kicking around and stuff. Sometimes that's good as well if you're able to sort of fuse the two.
I suppose it is about getting the balance right. As much as I suppose you enjoy that kind of controlled environment and borderline maybe regimental at times, and it's something I, you know, certainly enjoyed. You know, it was also nice as well to you're right, have that flexibility and have the bit more, you could say, laissez-faire approach at times, yeah. You know, when you were even up to a club training. However, you know, it was mad to think that one was an amateur sport and the other one was semi-pro, and you know, I suppose you were probably training hard and working harder in the amateur code, you know, and putting a lot more hours in and a lot more development in, and then the one that you're actually getting paid for, you had less hours of devotion maybe towards it. So in a roundabout way, it was weird in that sense, but I suppose in a way as well, they were balanced out, and I suppose that's not to discredit any of the managers as well that I would have worked on, because, you know, they would have, you know, asked us and understood, you know, if and whatever the games were, and they would have tried to, I suppose, keep us as healthy as possible to keep us on the pitch. So, you know, that was important as well. But it was nice. It was nice to have, again, that balance, and it was nice to have the different codes, and it was nice to obviously play in as many kind of arenas as well and different codes. And I know you touched on Big Jack Charton, you know, some of the memories of that Irish side, and just reading some of the articles now that kind of have come out about him, and I can remember even watching one of the tournaments that was down in, I think, possibly Palinskenry, where we were down at an under 14 competition fail out for Enniskillen and Gales, which we ended up winning as well. But I remember I think we jumped all around the pool table. I'm not sure which game it was whenever Ireland were playing in one of the major tournaments, and just listen, you know, it was just it was one of them things, and you know, we were all at a Gaelic tournament, you know, and obviously at under 14 level, you know, obviously really you know, looking forward to whatever was coming up in the next, you know, forthcoming days, whatever, and to have this event on, obviously, as well down there, it just made that kind of trip as well. So, you know, an iconic figure, and I suppose I, from everybody as well, and I think the whole nation has sent their condolences at this stage as well, but a brilliant man, and it just... good memories more than anything else, you know.
Yeah, I suppose he was really important, especially for somebody like you, because before him, like, you know, there was a bit of a divide. It was like you had your soccer people or your football people, and you had your GA people, and like there wasn't long before that where you weren't actually allowed to play both, you know. Yeah. And then someone like Jack Charlton, especially in the north, I think it was a bit more strict as well. Like, you do not play for that crowd down the road, but he comes in and then the whole country gets behind it, and then suddenly it's okay, it's cool, they play a bit of soccer as well.
Yeah, no, and I suppose he passed it on to some of the players as well, and I remember when I studied in Sunderland, actually, at the time, there was an influx of kind of Irish players at the time, and there was a behind closed doors game kind of played between ourselves and the university, and we actually ended up playing through I think it was a young lad that was doing physio in there, and again, I don't want to give any names out, but the Sunderland lads played us up in Durham possibly at the time, and we had a brilliant game. Your boy Butler was there, Ingham, we had the Rossiters, we had big Quinner was there, you know, and you're right when you talked about that kind of playing the soccer and playing the Gaelic, obviously then Quinn obviously brought it into his side, and I think that was the year that they went third or fourth in the Premiership when Sunderland were flying at that stage, but it was absolutely fantastic. They were down in all their Nike gear, and there was us, a crew of college boys, and I think it was on one of the St. Patrick's days as well, my first year possibly there. I can't remember the date now. The early age is kicking in at this stage, but it was fantastic just to play, and then I suppose you know that's, I think it was Quinn that actually organised the whole thing as well, so obviously that, you know, going back to Jack Charlton and that divide and crossing that divide, that obviously had seeped in this, sorry, Big Quinn as well, and he was flying that day actually as well, but again, they were like glass figurines. We weren't allowed to touch them that day. It was behind closed doors, and it was more the element of a bit of crack as well. But you know, he was an iconic figure, and obviously this and that has, you know, sparked a generation, and obviously it has ignited. A number of players to go on, and again, I suppose, you know, remember him in the best possible way as well, you know, by having events like that people don't know about until now, and I've hung probably the busy with this stage, but sure, he'd be all right, you know.
I got what I needed from you, Ryan.
He'll be googling that one now, right? This Irish video that we're doing there, but hopefully he's not listening.
Well, tell me, are you still in the hospital?
No, sorry. We are out in, it's like a business center now at the moment. We've opened up like a gym service out there. We actually opened up in my local club in Skilling Gaels. We were grateful to use their services at the start, and then we moved out to a local kind of estate in a business center, and we've set up a gym, myself and I suppose from on a player, Cahill Beacom. Cahill would have played a bit of soccer as well, so we're both multi-coded now in that sense. He would have played for Ballymannard and stuff as well, so we have a partnership now, and we have recovery services, and then we have a gym unit, and we were actually just last week turning over the gym unit as well to make it COVID compliant.
Yeah, and I was actually, you were talking about running up and down the sideline there. Did you see Owen Mulligan's clip when he was in London? I think he was on the side.
I didn't want to mention that. I didn't want to mention that because I'm conscious we play obviously a number of thrown teams, so I didn't want anything to come back to haunt me, but I've seen that all right now. He's obviously a top player, and I'm sure he'll probably breach into management at some stage, although I think he could still play at this level anyway, and still play at club level. I think he's still across the water at the moment, am I right in saying, so I don't know if he can get back, but I know the club are
Yeah, I just saw him.
He's a massive loss to the club, and they'd love to have him back, you know.
Yeah, I just saw him on the sideline in one of the games, and he wasn't playing. Yeah. A player was running up, and Owen Mulligan crossed the line, hit him with a shoulder.
you do what you have to do. I don't know if I go that far, but I'm saying that, you know, the game takes you, and then whatever will be, I suppose. So listen, needs must nearly at times, and I'm sure if it was last minute stuff to maybe win a championship or something like that, God knows what might come out of me, you know. Yeah. So if it's in you, it's in you. So, nah, you can't deny the man that. And I'm sure he got a slap on the wrist and the deal was done then, you know.
Yeah. Well, here, Ryan, thanks a million. I'm sure I'll see you at the next bonfire night.
Well, I'm going to have to go Googling here to see what the story is, but no. Well, thanks so much for your time as well, and hope we're all safe, and we'll chat soon.
No bother. Best of luck. You can't touch this.
You can't touch this. A few weeks later, they played Kilkenny below Nolan Park, the same year. Can't touch this. And they were being hockey. But the camera went in, there was a fella warming up. Well, Jesus, you should see him. Yeah, the fuck? He was massive. Legs, ass, built. But I bust out laughing watching him. There he was, the epitome of what I said. I told you, homeboy, you can't touch this. Yeah, that's
how we living, and you know, you can't touch this. Look at my eyes, man. Okay, so we'll start with Joe Brolly. Who else? It's unbelievable. Like the soapbox that Joe Brolly still has. I was actually on the RTE podcast the other day, and I made the mistake of talking about Joe Brolly on the Sunday game. I could see him sweating under the collar. I did correct it to talk about him being on Air Sport now, but just it's amazing. Like, he writes something and he just sets the agenda, and everyone else starts talking about it. Even this, he's not talking about anything in particular, and actually his point isn't great, but it's just still some lovely little anecdotes along the way. And of course, it starts with his favorite person, Owen Mulligan. I've never known a love as pure as Joe Brolly's and Owen Mulligan's. So he's describing leaving Croke Park in 2005, through the tunnel, past the changing rooms, out to the coach exit. And now this is a quote. And there he was, standing big in the evening sun, bleached blonde hair, looking left and right. It sounded like a Carly Rae Jepsen song at the stage. It was Owen Mulligan, and the big man was standing alone. Anyway, so it's good chat. Like, he's gone about Owen Mulligan, like, you know, just not sitting well with him being so famous, and wants to go out for a few quiet pints with Joe. But a couple of good stories there about, you know, telling Mickey Hart that his granny had died on a few occasions just so he could miss a few sessions. It sort of reminded me of Dennis Rodman and the Chicago Bulls. He liked to just go off and do his own thing for a week and miss training and, you know, come back refreshed. But yeah, Joe Brolly told the story of Owen Mulligan telling the story, as Joe Brolly always does, of Mickey Hart coming to his, it was 4 years later, and his granny actually did pass away, and Mickey Hart came in, shook his hand, you know, said he was sorry for his loss or whatever. And a few minutes later, Hart was sitting there, and he sort of nudged him in the elbow and says, "So, she's finally dead." Yeah. Yeah. That was nice.
Stephen Ireland could have got a lesson or two off Owen Mulligan on how to deliver the news that your grandparents have passed away when they actually haven't passed away. Yeah, I suppose it was different in Owen's case. He was just usually just doing it either so he could go on the beer, or because he was already on the beer and didn't want to go training. I thought the best part was when his clubmate was Raymond McGrew.
Yeah.
It was only a young player coming up at the time, and he texted, he was on the beer, and he said he was half caught, he couldn't go to training. So he texts Raymond McGrew and he says, "Oh, tell Mickey my granny has passed away." And Raymond McGrew's like, "I can't tell him that." He's like, go on, it'll be fine." So he pulls up to training, Raymond McGrew does, and Mickey Hart comes over to him and asks him where Owen Mulligan is. And Raymond McGrew says, "He told me to tell you his granny has passed away," and all the boys heard it and started laughing. So I thought that was very funny. Listen, Joe, as usual, is really entertaining. The point of the column is lost in the middle somewhere.
Oh, my God.
All the anecdotes, but do you know, like, I came away like having enjoyed it. I'd like, whether I turned it away from it, I'm not sure, but certainly funny and really entertaining as usual.
I think that sums up Joe Brolly. It's like, I enjoyed it. I don't know if I got anything out of it, but I enjoyed it. Yeah. And like that piece, yeah, like there's absolutely nothing to do with it. The old Mulligan thing is just thrown in there for no real reason. It tells a good story, and you think it's getting to the point of this is the point of it, where, you know, Peter Canavan got onto Owen Mulligan for
Yeah.
He fisted over a point when he was 3-on-goals, 2-on-1. And apparently Owen Mulligan felt sorry for Fermanagh, so he just threw it over. I think this was on their sports show between Mulligan and Robbie. And he said the Canavan came over and he was like, "What the fuck are you playing at?" And he was shocked. "And what do you mean?" And he said, "What the fuck are you playing at?" And I, this is Brawley writing, but I just said, "What?" And Canavan was raging. He said, "We were 3-on-goal and you took a point." I said, "We were 18 points up, Peter." And Canavan said, "Don't do it again. I'm warning you. We're here to play, not fuck around." And I thought, "Oh, that's great. And this is the point. Tyrone are serious." And then he just goes off on it in the direction he wants to go off in. And it's about Matty Donnelly. And he texted Matty Donnelly about no knockout football and, you know, not being going through the motions. And Donnelly said, "I can't wait." And like that. So basically the last five paragraphs were sort of the point of it. It was like knockout football. That's what he wants. But and I think everybody likes that. And Brawley used the example, but I think it was a bad example of Derry v Down. And that was an amazing game in 94, like unbelievable. And the fact that it was knockout maybe did add to it. But I sort of look at that as a shame that Derry are down or gone in the first round, the same way Tyrone or Donegal are gone in the first round. Like, you know, I would love those two to meet each other in a quarterfinal or an Ulster final. You know, just it's almost like if Federer and Nadal in their primes met each other in the first round of Wimbledon 2 weeks ago. You know, it's just, it's not the same. So if it's knockout, I would like it to be done properly, but sure, whatever.
Yeah. The implication, though, again, there's a pull quote from it as well. The pull quote is Matty Donnelly saying, "I can't wait." But, like, the implication from Joe Brawley is that Matty Donnelly is looking forward to that game with Donegal even more this year because it's knockout. But
yeah,
I bet you if Donegal were playing Tyrone next year and it wasn't knockout and Joe Brawley was texting Matty Donnelly about it, he'd also say, "I can't wait." I don't know as Matty Donnelly is as enshrined to the idea of knockout football as Joe is, but, you know, credit to Joe. He makes it seem like that, like the way he writes it in the piece.
We were talking about Jack Charlton there. You had sent me on a piece of Gerlach Nans, was it?
Yeah, it's in the Star today. So there's a pullout in the Star of just a Jack Charlton pullout. And obviously there's going to be loads of anecdotes and stuff, and you mightn't expect it, but there's one from Gerlach Nan. He tells a story of how the Clare team were gathered in a hotel in Dublin the morning of the All-Ireland final. I think it was versus Offaly. I think it was in 1995. So that the Irish team were in the same hotel at the time. It was near the airport. So this is the morning of the All-Ireland final, and the Irish team were all there. So Gerlach Nan said that, like, in the hours before they left for Croke Park, they all gathered in the room with the selectors and the physios, and stuff like that. And they used to randomly call players to be called up for a physio appointment, but it essentially was just to have a chat about them and try and calm their nerves and stuff like that. So Gerlach Nan noticed that Jack Charlton was staying in the same hotel room floor, and he saw him pass by, and he noted the room that Jack was going into. So he said he started ringing around the hotel rooms of the players that were coming up for a physio appointment, and just to knock a bit of crack out in the morning, you know, of the All-Ireland final, that he told the players that were coming up for physio that the room number of their room was actually Jack Charlton's room number. So all the players started coming up, and they had the door open because they knew what was happening. And they said that all the players were knocking on Jack Charlton's door. Jack Charlton was opening the door and slamming it in their faces. He said after a while that after it happened five or six times, that Jack Charlton just left the door open and sat in front of the door just with his legs crossed to kind of intimidate anyone who might think about doing it again. But I just thought it was gas, especially from somebody like Lachnan, who I thought would have been treating it kind of far more serious in the morning of an All-Ireland final. But you can imagine, like, you're nervous enough. You're going off for physio, then you knock on the door and Jack Charlton answers it. So that was just very funny, very funny.
Yeah, that's great. And like that, yeah, that stage, the work is done. There's no need for posturing. You can have a bit of crack and focus at the right time. It's spoken like a man who was never in an All-Ireland final.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we mentioned Dennis Walsh's piece in the Sunday Times. So it probably is pretty, it's a very good piece and important enough. He's got a good line in it where he says, one house party, that's the three Cork clubs, one house party and one COVID positive party goer was enough to force four clubs to take evasive action. And basically his whole thing is, this can work. And we were always told that there was going to be a risk to this, but it's up to the players now. Like, you know, so his thing is that for the GA, this is the opportunity they were waiting for. We were all waiting for the numbers to go right down, the R number to go down, the cases to go into single digits. We got there. But now not messing it up hinges on thousands of players making many thousands of good decisions. And that's it. Like, you know, like you mentioned, the player like having the COVID test and not telling anybody, and, you know, and then the people who are maybe not following the guidelines outside of training and then going to training, like, you know, it's tough, I get it, and everybody's probably fatigued, but if you do want to play and you don't want it all to be messed up, especially in your county, then it is incumbent on you to take that action, because you could be the one who messes it up.
Yeah, like he refers back to an interview that Killian De Gascon did back in May, I think, where he was kind of saying that, like, you know, until there's a vaccine, and like there's you know, no sign that there's going to be a vaccine anytime soon, that when society does eventually resume, I mean, when Killian De Gascon gave this interview, it was either at the peak or not far past the peak of the impact of the pandemic in Ireland. But when society does eventually resume, and this obviously includes sport, that there's going to be a level of risk. So it's a level of risk that people deem kind of acceptable. So when it comes to return of GAA, the level of risk that we have at the moment is what the government and what people participating in it have, you know, considered acceptable. But but for that to work, that's entirely dependent on the actions of the individuals and the individual clubs within the GAA. And just what's happened in the last week or so goes to show, you mightn't think anything of it, you know, like I'm sure people who went to a house party didn't think, oh, sure, you know, I can go to a house party, it's fine. And then they realized that, like, oh, wait, well, then four clubs have had to shut down because basically one or two people went to a house party, or, you know, this might happen elsewhere, where I don't know what happened with that guy I referred to who didn't tell management afterwards that he had had a COVID test and he'd already trained with his club. It's just, but basically that's not going to be acceptable. That's not going to be tolerated anymore. And if you want this to work, and we all want this to work, it's the like huge individual responsibility on you, because we're not in a professional environment where players and clubs are getting tested and you know, managed within an inch of their lives, and the responsibility is taken out of their hands. This is ordinary club players, so the responsibility very much and the onus lays on you. So, like, hopefully what's happened, as I said earlier, hopefully what has happened in the last week or so will kind of, you know, wake people up to the need to cop on. And because if they don't, we're going to be hearing a lot more than this. And as we kind of flagged at the very start, we could be looking at a case where, you know, the worst case scenario, the like seasons are abandoned altogether.
Bang on. Colm O'Rourke, haven't always completely agreed with his pieces. They're always decent and they're always strong, and he sticks to his point, like Joe Brawley. But this is a good point he's making. So he's talking about a player in Meath at the start. I had me back up thinking, where's he going with this? Is somebody who played football, he got a bit of football at the start of the year before everything shut down, and now he's got 2 months of football. And I was thinking, well, what's wrong with that? Everybody has the same thing. But his problem is clubs, or his point is clubs would have no problem playing league matches when their top players have gone off to play county. You know, when it's up to the county boards to do that. Like, that's the thing. This isn't an inter-county problem. If your county isn't scheduling matches beyond the championship, then like that's they're the ones who aren't catering for you. And in Dublin, they have a cup competition planned. You know, if you go out in the championship group, you have a cup competition that could take you right into October. You know, so if you're really desperate for games, you're going to get it. And I come back to the thing where what O'Rourke is saying, I can talk about the county boards. I actually think that the clubs could be a bit of a problem here as well, though, because he's saying the clubs won't have a problem playing league matches. I think this is where a lot of the issue comes with fixtures, is that clubs don't want to play without their best team, and their best players are obviously the county players, and especially when there's relegation and stuff on the line. But a lot of counties have catered for that. Monaghan do it well in a point system where it's worth more if your county players are available. Most places have playoffs for this reason, so you're not going to go straight down. You know, you'll have a chance with your best team, then you get back out of the playoffs. And I actually think when your county players aren't available, it gives people a chance who wouldn't play. You know, they are now playing in that team and getting more games. So it's up to the clubs and county boards to start pushing for that a bit more. And especially if we're all paying membership, like we've paid full membership this year, it could push for a few more games. And like, maybe if you don't want to have any relegation in the league or whatever else, you can talk about that. But if the issue really is that the club players aren't getting enough games, you can play games when the county players are gone. You can play them.
You hit on a good point there. It is up to both. I mean, like, it is up to both the county board, because a lot of clubs, like, we're not playing any league in Mayo. That was decided a couple of weeks ago. So, like, we're playing championship, and then we're playing divisional cup games to kind of keep players ticking over and stuff like that. And there'll be divisional cup games either side of the championship. But it's still, there's no league. So, like, that would have been because there'd be a lot of there'd be a lot of teams in Mayo, I would imagine, that would be, you know, doubtful of how they'd be able to, are doubtful of how it would go without their county players because they're so reliant on their county players. So in that instance, if the county board was strong enough, they said, well, you know, we're going to, I know this was but to a vote, so I can't argue with that, because I'd say the county board would probably say, well, we put it to a vote and the clubs voted not to have a league.
Yeah.
But you could say that it could be taken out of the club's hand and said, we're going to play the competition anyway, just to make sure that, you know, the players who want games at that end of the year are facilitated, you know. Now, like, I'm probably the wrong person to ask. I'm not exactly up in arms. Like, I'm one of the older players. Like, I think you've given out about this occasionally as well. Like, I'm not exactly unhappy at the moment at the prospect of a shorter season.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I don't mind if it ends in October and I get to, you know, play a bit of five-a-side and keep myself ticking over. But, like, I can definitely understand the frustrations of somebody who's looking at it now, you know, thinking, like Colm O'Rourke says in Meath, that they're, you know, they're looking at maybe six games. And they're thinking, geez, I'd want way more than that. And especially when you come down to issues like having paid membership, you know, to get a lot more than that. So the likes of soccer, for example, would have they seem to be, from my experience at least, you know, trying to make more of an effort to have as normal a season as usual, despite everything that's going on. Now, granted, they don't have the kind of club versus county game, but I think it's a good piece by O'Rourke. Now, I think as well, like, he sums it up in one sentence. It's, club players just want regular games. Are they asking too much? At least they know when they are getting a game. So that's an argument that's not necessarily confined to the COVID pandemic, but it does make sense now as much in the general scheme of things as well.
Mm. And sometimes I think there's a bit of an imbalance in the media coverage, because, like, yeah, for me and you here thinking, well, this is great, we've got a shorter season. I know people who have come back to play just a season because it's not as long a season as it normally is. And yeah. I think when you read Pat Spillane's piece, or we're better to finish, he's talking about the inter-county game, and he's saying it's supposed to be a leisure time pursuit. And it's like, get off the stage, Pat. Like, you know, this is the top sport in the country, and he's saying it's supposed to be a kick around. Like, and he's talking about he's worried about losing players, and he compares it to the American model, which is completely wrong way to go. So he's saying that they have mass participation up until 12, and then people lose out and they start missing out. And but that's because everything in America is designed that way. Like, beyond sport, the culture, it's all elitist, it's capitalist, and they're unashamed about that. And it's like, that's the whole idea of sport. It's like, if you don't make your college team after high school, then you're finished. And it's depressing, but that's the way it is. And the GA isn't like that. It starts with club. It's all started with club, whereas the American sports system has started with the American dream and the idea of making it and being the 1%. And if you're not going to be the 1%, then there's no point. Whereas the GA system starts with club, and if there was no county, the club would continue going anyway. And I think he's just got that wrong. He's making the point about under 14 development squads, and I get that point, and look, I could live without them, but, you know, like, I played in one development squad, and, like, you went away on a Saturday and you felt great. You were sort of picking up from what other people in different counties were doing. And, like, you weren't missing. Like, I've coached teams where you're losing those players. That's fine. They're gone on a Saturday. They're training with better players. I don't see a problem with that either. I can live without it. But, you know, just this attack and this panic that club is going to die a death, I just don't get it.
Yeah, I didn't really know where to start with this piece by Pat Spillane, to be honest, because there is so much in it. And essentially, I think it essentially boils down to, obviously, elitism in the GAA, and now it's driving a wedge between club and county, and a huge reason for the drop in participation levels in the GAA at a certain age, like, I'd say, certainly from minor onwards. And listen, I agreed with him on a few things that he said. The training to playing ratio is way too high. The reason why soccer is probably the highest participation sport that we referenced there again, that there's probably more of a focus on enjoyment, and there's definitely a more, you know, you have way better idea of, you know, being able to plan a schedule. And there's a lot to be said for that, especially for people who might have a more casual kind of interest in the sport. But I agree with what you're getting at as well, and that, like, say his point on the centres of excellence, like, I can see why it could be problematic in that there's a danger of, you know, making, you know, a 14-year-old or a 15-year-old potentially seem elite in comparison to his clubmates and stuff like that, maybe. But that can be, there's ways of handling that as opposed to them not having them all together. Like, on the other hand, like, playing for your county is such a badge of honor for a young player. And not only that, but, like, if counties don't have their act in order, you know, in terms of their underage structures and stuff like this, you can see like an Offaly being the most recent example until they kind of got their house in order of how that can impact not just on senior level, but kind of on the status of a county as a whole and stuff like that. So like, it's not as simplistic as kind of what Pat was laying out there. And as for just to say as well, as for like calling playing inter-county a leisure activity, of all people to be saying that, Pat Spillane, I mean, like, we're talking, I think it was a few weeks ago, we referenced that how Pat was on about his training schedule when he was playing for Kerry, and his mother used to let him sleep till 12 in the day. And now I'm actually rereading a brilliant book by Michael Foley. You referenced Michael Foley earlier. I'm rereading Kings of September at the moment. It's about Offaly beating Kerry to deny them the 5 in the row. And it's just like, at the moment I'm reading about when Pat Spillane got injured and the lengths to which he was going to try and get himself back. And there's nothing leisure about that, I can tell you. Do you know? So like, there's an element of hypocrisy there as well. But, you know, as the saving grace for Pat Spillane, as usual, he did include a quote.
So
this time it was from Abraham Lincoln. I think you might elaborate.
You got 5 quid on Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is the beauty of Pat Spillane. Like, you'll never be able to guess his quotes. He's going from Dolly Parton to Abraham Lincoln. Like, this man's got a portfolio that he can call on. And it was, democracy is government of, by, and for the people. And that's how he wrapped up his column. And I think that's how we'll wrap up the show, unless there's anything else you want to chat about.
There was one thing I wanted to mention, Conan. So my club, Kajma GA, are running a fundraiser this weekend. It's a 24-hour fundraiser. It's going to start on Saturday at 12. It's going to run till 12 the following day on the Sunday. So it's a memory of a clubmate of mine who passed away a couple of months ago. And the fundraiser is designed to support the Sloyne Family Support Fund. So the name of my clubmate was Dara Sloyne. So the Sloyne Family Support Fund can be found on idonate.ie. And there's details of the event. I won't go into too much details about the event itself. It can be found on the Celtic Magia Facebook page if anyone wants to know. But all donations that are welcome, you know, towards the Sloyne Family Support Fund, that can be found on idonate.ie. So just this weekend, on the hour, every hour, we're going to have people running / walking / soloing a 5K route around the town. We're hoping to keep it going for 24 hours. So yeah, if anyone here is interested that lives in the vicinity of the Kajma area, there's details, as I said, on the Kajma Twitter and the Kajma Facebook page. So get in touch. And yeah, again, that's the donation page, which is designed to provide practical assistance for Dara's family. That can be found on idonate.ie, and the name of it is Sloyne Family Support Fund.
Lovely stuff. Soon to be Jack Charton GAA club down in Kilsyth. Yeah. No, that's great stuff. And yeah, we'll leave it there, then, I suppose, on a nice note, and a nice thing to be doing. Yeah, and we'll see you next week.
And when I started running, I suppose I didn't stop. And when I got the chance to go, I said I should go, so it opened up.
We're only the small little fish out there, so we are, and we're trying hard to make it through. But it's hard to get the breaks when you're the smaller fish.
Because I love this county so much, you know. And it's just, I'm delighted that the lads did it for the people of Waterford today, because, like, I'm heartbroken. Let it go, cause I won't see you later, but not a lot of talking out. I said I'd go, promise I won't show, but I'm still trying to